how we feed our pets. We serve pet food in a bowl. If it is a raw pet food, if it is a contaminated pet food, dogs, they come, they chew, they consume. And unlike human, we don't wipe their mouths, right? If salmonella is attached on their mouths, whisper, etc., now the pets will come, hug you, kiss you, lick you. Then you get the salmonella from them.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Blending passion for customer success with love for pet nutrition, Trow Nutrition. Kemen Pet Food and Rendering is dedicated to supporting longer, fuller pet lives. Biorigin, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Rengen Pet Nutrition, we partner with a purpose.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Pet Food Science Podcast, where we seek to discuss current research and how it may apply to innovation in the pet food industry. I'm your host, Dr. Giulia Pazzali, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Janik Dhakal about the topic of pet food safety. Welcome to our podcast, Janik.
Oh, thank you, Giulia. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about pet food safety, do you mind sharing with our audience a little bit about your background and how you end up in your current position today?
So I was born and raised in Nepal. It is a small country between India and China. I received my bachelor's in veterinary science and animal husbandry. Then I also worked as a large animal practitioner for a very brief period of time, less than a year. Then I did my master's, again, both from India. I came to US for my PhD from Mississippi State University. I received my PhD in poultry science, but my research focus was in food safety, food microbiology, focusing on salmonella. After my PhD, I worked for a company for a brief period of time, again, maybe less than a year. I was actually laid off. Then I joined K-State in Pet Food Lab with Dr. Greg Aldrich, where I had a great pleasure working with the whole team and work extensively in the area of pet food safety, mostly controlling salmonella in both pet foods as well as pet food ingredients. Currently, I'm working at University of Maryland Eastern Shore as an assistant professor of animal sciences. I think that's about me.
That's awesome, man. I had a pleasure of working with Janik as well when he was here at K-State. I was doing my master's and he was doing his postdoc. So it was very nice to reconnect and see that we are both still working with pet food. So it means a good area to be in.
Yep.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A DietForge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with non-linear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
And since you're a professor there at university and working with pet food, I imagine, can you share with us what current research you're working on or what your lab can offer to the industry?
So that's a good question. My lab currently is focused on food safety and food microbiology. So that means I'm working on both human side as well as pet food side. I have currently three active projects going on. One of the major projects is we received a USDA fund. And it is interesting that this is one of the first projects that USDA has, to my knowledge, a USDA has ever funded on pet food safety. Otherwise, usually USDA, it's not their research area, research interest area, priority area. USDA pet food safety project I have that I'm leading that, where we are looking into the pet food surveillance on salmonella, their antibiotic resistance pattern, followed by some novel antimicrobials that could be used in pet food to mitigate salmonella. Again, focuses on salmonella. We are using different natural antimicrobials, chemicals, acidulants, and we are also working on bacteriophages against multi-drug resistant salmonella that could be found in pet food. My another project is on poultry, so maybe we can talk about that later on.
No, that's awesome. I'm glad to hear that we have federal agencies, you know, worry about pet food and understanding the importance of it and supporting research on that.
Right. If you don't mind sharing interesting fact about the project, what happened was, Julia, back when I was applying for the grant, my internal committee in the university, they review the grant before they can send it and they select, okay, these can go, these cannot go. And my grant was rejected. My pre-proposal was rejected because the committees told me this doesn't fit the USDA priority area because it is pet food. Then I had to bargain. I had a meeting with the USDA program leader, with other my co-PIs, and I convinced them, hey, this is our justification why USDA should consider this. And USDA program leader, actually, they agreed, okay, then you can submit it, we'll keep into consideration. And ultimately, it ended up being funded.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it's a good, you know, learning opportunity and for everyone in academia. And for academia, you have to be resilient. And then if you hear no, you don't take it. You just try it again and then find other ways. There's always, you know, if one door closes, there are windows. And very cool that you are able to make that work.
Right, right.
So if we are talking about pet food safety, you are doing work in this area, there is USDA funding, so it means it's a very important area to think about. So why is pet food safety, you know, so much talked about nowadays?
Well, when we talk about pet food safety, first of all, we need to know what are the pathogens of concern. In pet food, some pathogens like E. coli, Listeria are also sometimes concerning pathogens. However, Salmonella is the most concerning pathogens in pet food. Salmonella is a bug. It's a gram-negative bacteria. It is basically ubiquitous. It could be found anywhere, dust, soil, mostly food processing environment, etc. And when we talk about pet food constitute like almost 60% of the pet food weight by weight is the ingredients are from animal-derived ingredients, unlike maybe just like 2% of the cattle feed is animal-derived ingredients. And that Salmonella bug is commonly present in warm-blooded animals. Poultry is a very common source of Salmonella. Like 30, 40, sometimes even 60% of the poultry samples that are positive in Salmonella. And the pet food, poultry as a whole, poultry, the chicken, turkey, eggs, etc., is a major constituent of pet foods. So having said that, the prevalence of Salmonella in pet food will be relatively higher if they are not properly processed, not properly treated, or if you are feeding raw pet food that constitute of, again, poultry. So that is one of the reasons this is an important topic. Another is the feeding habit, how we feed our pets. We serve pet food in a bowl. If it is a raw pet food, if it is a contaminated pet food, dogs, they come, they chew, they consume. And unlike human, we don't wipe their mouths, right? If Salmonella is attached on their mouths, whisper, etc., now the pets will come, hug you, kiss you, lick you, then you get the Salmonella from them. That is another thing. So another thing is how these, we are doing serving the pet foods, the bowels. The feed bowels, water bowels, are we equally concerned about cleaning and sanitation of the bowels that we offer to the pets as much as we do for ourselves? Probably not, right? We don't clean and sanitize them with the same effectiveness as we do for humans. And they come to our kitchen sink, kitchen dining table, etc., then the cross-contamination. Another major thing is, who are the handlers of pets and pet foods at home? Mostly, they are either kids, young kids, or elderlies. So they are handling pets and pet foods. And interestingly or ironically, that is the group which is immunocompromised or elderly vulnerable. So if there is a Salmonella contamination, we are actually exposing the vulnerable population, vulnerable group, to the pets and pet foods. And studies have shown that there are a couple of outbreaks, recent outbreaks in 2023 and 2024, where kids, almost like 80-85% of the illness, that Salmonella-related illness from pet food, were in kids and infants. In fact, the 2023 outbreak in Texas, one of the manufacturers of the dry pet food, that lead to outbreaks in human. There were, I think, 7 illnesses. Out of 7, 6 of them were very, very serious and ironic that they were infants, either 1 year or below 1 year age. So all these things will make us think that how serious pet food safety is and how concerning it is.
Yeah, I know for sure of all the statistics is it is a serious concern and we need to consider. But just to make it clear, there is pet food is regulations is salmonella should be is tolerance zero. So it's not that we are not doing what we're supposed to do, but there is some always there is like ways that can get contamination, but the regulations it should be salmonella zero, right?
Yeah, so just there is a zero tolerance policy. That's true.
So maybe what are the major types of pet food that may have outbreaks? Where do you mind just share where they're maybe coming from, or like where there may be some steps that may be failing of not getting that salmonella zero?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I have I have a data in front of me. Actually, our lab had just recently submitted a comprehensive review paper on salmonella on pet food, and revision one is due today. I have to submit it after this meeting, and hopefully this will be accepted, and this will be a very good source for all the industry and academia people out there. What we have seen is, upon analyzing the recalls starting from 1999, the major recalls, then we found that there were 116 different recalls with 119 different feed types. We found that almost 30% of those were from raw pet foods. And similarly, similar number was from dry, and the treats were a little higher that time. 33% were from dry treats. However, because the raw pet food trend was increasing recently, in recent years, last 10, 15 years, we broke the data from 2015 to 2024. And to my surprise, we found that more than half, 53% of the recalls, salmonella-linked recalls in pet foods, were just in raw pet food. So raw pet food was that much contaminated with salmonella. So this is the breakdown that we have found.
What is raw pet food? Simple question, but I think sometimes it's important to go back to the basics. And
oh, okay. So sure. So pet foods are considered raw when it contains meat, bones, or organs like liver, heart, chicken liver, turkey liver, chicken hearts, etc., or even the raw vegetables. But the most important thing here is they don't go to the cooking or treating process. So there is no any intervention steps to mitigate potential pathogens within them. So those are considered raw pet foods.
So they don't have any heat application, right? So that's it.
Yeah, no heat or no chemical. And the interesting thing about raw pet food is these pet owners prefer raw pet food because they have some anecdotal thought going on that raw pet food, feeding raw pet food to their dogs or cats, mostly dogs, make them more vigor, more like wilderly instinct, and they have some nutrition benefits, etc. However, scientific evidence is that don't support that the raw pet food are superior in nutrition quality as compared to treated or cooked pet foods. And in fact, the FDA, US FDA, they do not recommend feeding raw pet food. It is clearly stated in their website that we do not recommend feeding raw pet food to the dogs.
I mean, like mild heat helps with nutrient digestibility or bioavailability. Too much heat is going to decrease a little bit. So that's one big point of like feeding raw is going to be more available. That's some of the considerations. But I mean, even the highly processed, but there is still provide sufficient nutrients.
Right. It is, again, there is a balance, Julia. What at the cost of, so maybe there is a slight change in nutrition, but will that be good to compromise with the safety? Is that something that you want to compromise with the safety when you want to try to save tiny, penny amount of vitamins or proteins? So
yeah, no, there are many nutritional costs, safety, many aspects you consider. And sometimes people have, food philosophy, feeding philosophy, any philosophy. And then I think the industry tries to address all of those. And then we just need to make sure they're all safe, you know, when they are in the hands of pets. I think there's room for everything if we do it properly and consider. And any type of pet food is going to have its own challenge for sure.
That's true.
And there's some technology today that is trying to, that is used to eliminate salmonella. But it's always like, it's a challenge. It's not something that's easy. And then there is research, that technology research and teamwork that needs to be done as well all together to make sure we...
Right. New technologies are emerging where
the
freshness of the raw pet food is maintained. The freshness quality is, kept uncompromised where the pathogens are mitigated. So technologies are being immersed.
Salmonella is for sure, it is a concern. And dogs and cats are usually more resistant compared to humans. So that becomes the problem. And then the immunocompromised population that you mentioned. Is there any death of caused by salmonella originating from pet foods in the past that you know? Or
in human, or you were talking about the pets?
Humans, I mean.
So that's an interesting thing. So when we looked into the illness, so as I mentioned, out of these 119 different outbreaks that we have, we noticed there were 11 different, 119 recalls. There were 11 different outbreaks in human population. So those outbreaks means the illnesses caused by pet food, the salmonella contamination from pet food, is causing illness to the human population. So there are number of illnesses. So going back to that 2023 outbreak, there were 7 illnesses. And out of them, 6 were infants, 1 year or below. Whereas in 2024, a raw pet food outbreak, that led to 44 illnesses and even 13 hospitalizations. And all these 11 different outbreaks, they cause illnesses. Regarding deaths, so there was one outbreak in 2017 to 2019, between this time frame, raw turkey outbreaks that was intended for both human as well as pets. There was one death during that outbreak. However, it is not very clearly distinct whether that outbreak was from the raw turkey food from pets or that was for human purpose. So there was one death, but it is not very clearly distinguished. In addition, another alarming thing that we also recorded in this manuscript that is out of those 116 total recalls, 11 of them were human outbreaks, and out of 11, 5 of them were multidrug resistant. This is a little concerning, right? So multidrug resistant bacteria, now they are being transmitted to pets, and then pets are actually now transmitting to human.
Yeah, no, definitely. And when you talk about solutions or next step, that's, I think, a part of your research, right? Do you mind sharing a little bit what are some steps or like new technology or new strategies that you are working on or like people should be looking at in the case of, I would say, like raw pet food, because it's, the one for sure more concerning.
Right. No, that's a good question. So raw pet food is the major concern here because they are not treated with any pathogen intervention or any thermal process. So some of the commercially used process, let me call it, there are many other processes such as plasma, irradiation technologies, they are being tried, but they are not very successful or customer perception is not very good on those. People will be, hey, this is an irradiation-treated X-ray, irradiation rays, so they have different perception, even though they are effective and they are recommended. But other commonly used processes are HPP, high-pressure processing, is one of the very common processes they are commonly used. There are certain limitations with that also, but this process is one of the processes different in commercial scale, commercial industries, as well as big research lab, they are working on this, where basically the packaged foods are treated at very high pressure that will kill pathogen without disrupting the freshness of the raw pet food. And now the pet food that comes out of the HPP will be pathogen free, but having the same taste, same sensory properties, same nutrient properties. So that is one study very commonly going on. Another study that our lab is also currently doing is using bacteriophages. Basically, what bacteriophages are, they are viruses, but good viruses. Those viruses are present everywhere, everywhere in soil, in sewers, everywhere. Those viruses, they are isolated and they are very specific to Salmonella. They can kill only the Salmonella if we target using that. Bacteriophages, they are solution. They come in a solution. They are targeted against Salmonella only. They are very natural. There is no chemical, no heat treating, no irradiation, nothing. So those bacteriophages, they are also now commonly used. Not commonly. In research lab, they are very commonly used. In commercial scale, there is one 40 friend or something, one in UAE, one commercial pet food producer they are using. I think, to my knowledge, that is the only one pet food producer in the world currently using bacteriophages. That is considered a natural also. That is another alternative to use to kill Salmonella in pet food. We are also trying some acidulants like sodium bisulfate, some organic acids. Those acidulants also we are trying in our lab. And in the past, I worked with some medium chain fatty acids also. The problem with medium chain fatty acids and some natural oils, I think University of Connecticut, they have used Dr. Anoop and their group, they are using this thing on pet food. The problem is the sensory. The dogs are sometimes, they don't like the sensory properties. So they alter the sensory properties sometimes so much that they prefer, we had seen that they prefer control over the treated. So we have to find out some other additives that could mask the flavor of those antimicrobials, which can actually kill the pathogens.
Yeah, it's a balance between food safety, but also animal acceptance. And
Exactly. So dogs, they don't understand that like human, hey, this is good for health. So compromise with the test. Sometimes we may, but dogs, they're not. They don't like.
That's why I like working with pet food. It's a puzzle. You know, it's not only one or another. It's like you fix one, okay, well, it doesn't connect with this other one. So it's...
That's true.
Sure, a big puzzle.
That's true.
It's time for our famous three.
Tired of navigating the pet food industry alone? The Pet Food Inner Circle brings together the brightest minds in pet nutrition, where seasoned professionals share real insights and tackle the challenges that matter most. When you need answers, industry leaders are just a conversation away. Ready to join the circle? Visit petfoodinnercircle.com and connect with your peers today.
Well, thank you very much, Janik. I think it was great to learn about what you're doing, some of our research, and some very important information that you share. I think that food safety is always going to be an important area of pet food, same as human food. And there's a lot to learn and to apply science. And but I think the industry overall does a great job, and they are concerned about this. And then they invested in make sure we feed a very healthy food, you know, pet food for our pets, but also that is safe for everyone dealing with that.
Sure.
So before I let you go, I want to ask you two questions not related to food safety. One is, do you have any favorite book or resource outside agriculture that you like? Maybe a book that you read or a website that you always go for news or something?
Well, that's a good question, Julia. I don't usually get time to read these novels and other than the curriculum. I think you are on the same boat. But the last time I read the book was The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. This book, I really enjoyed this book where the Sefford, I think his name was Santiago from Spain. He went to pyramids. He was having this recurrent dream about this dream about the fortune, hidden fortune. Then how he reached pyramid, different obstacles he encountered. Like there were thieves, they were robbing. There were some people who tried to misguide him. He also fell in love with one beautiful Arabian girl. Then all these obstacles, it didn't let him stop from his journey, and he actually reached there, and he achieved the goals. So none of those stopped. So that book was one book that I really liked it because the takeaway that I received, I gained from that book was focus on your goal and what he called in that book their personal legend. Personal legend. Focus on the personal legend and keep getting back, even if you fall multiple times, you know, to achieve your goal. The book will hint that to achieve your goal, but for me, I think it is a we have to make the realistic goal. You know, not we have if we make the realistic goal, then we can achieve it. So that's one of the book that I love it.
And very nice insights. It's about, you know, how many times, it's not how many times you fall, how many times you get up or how you get up. So, the USA grants a perfect example. So that fits really well.
Yeah, that was an interesting story.
The last one is you work with different universities, different, you know, also in the industry and probably work with a lot of students now. What do you think sets successful people apart? And successful is also a broad term, but that at least you deem successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, one of the many things that a successful person should have is a long-term vision, you know, foresight, long-term vision, not a short-term vision, a long-term vision about his future. He's like, if you are in the research or if you are in a business, think from a broad perspective. Time management is a very important thing that a successful person has learned. And basically, we all are learning. No one is perfect on that. But time management, effective use of the resources, those are things. Another thing, actually, I give this credit to Dr. Eldridge the most is how strong social and interpersonal skill should one have to be successful in academia or industry, whatever. This is one very important thing. And another is openness to continuous learning and improvement. You should always be a student. You are a teacher, but you are a student. So if you are more open to learning always, then I think you tend to be more successful in your area. That is one of the things those are a few things that I believe a successful person has or should have.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I agree with it. Well, thank you very much, Jenny, for joining us today. And I hope we come back in the future to share more about future results from your research and let us know how we can all learn from what you're doing. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Julia, and share my thoughts on this.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.